Good morning. On this National Day of Gluttony, 2015, my name is Michael McCusker. I wish to dedicate today's program to Francis Cook, whose last living birthday was on Thanksgiving Day, November 25th, 2010, 2 weeks before she died from ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Yesterday, she would have been 76, the spirit of we celebrate today, a fantastical affinity she would surely chide me about. Some thoughts with your turkey. Remember that our Thanksgiving is the result of stealing a continent away from civilizations which we buried and whose descendants we continue to treat with benign contempt. Remember that our intrusion wiped out entire species of wildlife and continued to render others close to extinction. Remember we made slaves of a race we have never quite freed. If we are to be truly thankful, we must remember how much of our bounty has been taken from others and how much we owe in return. Though the nation faces an age of scarcity, we have more than any other people at any other time. Yet among us are poor and hungry, and at least half the world's population subsists at the edge of starvation. We gorge ourselves. We flaunt our bounty. We worry that we are getting fat. And that was something I wrote, so I guess I should possibly give a bit of a disclaimer that that was my opinion, and perhaps my opinion anywhere. And that is about all that I've written for this program. And sort of in the context, Julie Snyder, who lives in Astoria and was once first sergeant of Clatsop Community Action when Chuck Wilder was its inaugural director, wrote a letter to the Daily Astorian earlier this month in reference to an article in its October 23rd issue, The Homeless Dilemma. She wrote, "I suggest that our community's bigger problem is, in fact, the 95% of homeless people," quote from the article, "who usually are just fine behaviorally, and not the 5% who insist on disrupting the tranquility of our lives. For those of us who have a home with a bathroom just down the hall, with closets and drawers in which to safely store our belongings, with a kitchen where we have a stove on which to cook the food we have in abundance and can save in the fridge, and a bedroom where in its warmth we can sleep through the night without fear of the elements, human and otherwise. For us, the real dilemma is how best to continue to ignore the realities of those 95 percenters." And that was Julie Snyder. Now I'd like to read something by Robert Jensen, No Thanks to Thanksgiving, which is not only the title, but the first sentence. Instead, we should atone for the genocide that was incited and condoned by the very men we idolize as our heroic founding fathers. One indication of moral progress in the United States would be the replacement of Thanksgiving Day and its self-indulgent family feasting with a national day of atonement accompanied by a self-reflective collective fasting. In fact, indigenous people have offered such a model. Since 1970, they have marked the fourth Thursday of November as a day of mourning in a spiritual political ceremony on Coles Hill overlooking Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts, one of the early sites of the European invasion of the Americas. Not only is the thought of such a change in this white supremacist holiday impossible to imagine, but the very mention of the idea sends most Americans into apoplectic fits, which speaks volumes about our historical hypocrisy and its relation to the contemporary politics of empire in the United States. That the world's great powers achieved greatness, and that's a quote, through criminal brutality on a grand scale is not news, of course. That those same societies are reluctant to highlight this history of barbarism also is predictable. But in the United States, this reluctance to acknowledge our original sin, the genocide of indigenous people, is of special importance today. It is now routine, even among conservative commentators, to describe the United States as an empire, so long as everyone understands we are an inherently benevolent one. Because all our history contradicts that claim, history must be twisted to serve the purposes of the powerful. One vehicle for taming history is various patriotic holidays, with Thanksgiving at the heart of U.S. myth-building. From an early age, we Americans hear a story about the hardy pilgrims whose search for freedom took them from England to Massachusetts. There, aided by the friendly Wampanoag Indians, they survived in a new and harsh environment, leading to a harvest feast in 1621, following the pilgrims' first winter. Some aspects of the conventional story are true enough, but it's also true that by 1637, Massachusetts Governor John Winthrop was proclaiming a Thanksgiving for the successful massacre of Pequot Indian men, women, and children, part of the long and bloody process of opening up additional land to the English invaders. The pattern would repeat itself across the continent until between 95% and 99% of American Indians had been exterminated and the rest were left to assimilate into white society or die off on reservations out of view of polite society. Simply put, Thanksgiving is the day when the dominant white culture and sadly, most of the rest of the non-white but non-indigenous population celebrates the beginning of a genocide that was, in fact, blessed by the men we hold up as our founding fathers. The first president, George Washington, in 1783, said he preferred to buy Indians' land rather than driving them off it because it was like driving, quote, wild beasts from the forest. He compared Indians to wolves, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. And that's a quote from Washington. Thomas Jefferson, President number 3, and principal author of the Declaration of Independence, which refers to Indians as the merciless Indian savages, was known to romanticize Indians and their culture, but that didn't stop him in 1807 from writing to his Secretary of War that in a coming conflict with certain tribes, quote, we shall destroy all of them. As the genocide was winding down in the early 20th century, Theodore Roosevelt, President number 26, defended the expansion of whites across the continent as an inevitable process, quote, due solely to the power of the mighty civilized races which have not lost the fighting instinct and which by their expansion are gradually bringing peace to the red wastes where the barbarian people of the world hold sway. Roosevelt also once said, I don't go so far to think that the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. How does a country deal with the fact that some of its most revered historical figures had certain moral values and political views virtually identical to Nazis? Here's how respectable politicians, pundits, and professors play the game. When invoking a grand and glorious aspect of our past, then history is all important. We are told how crucial it is for people to know history, and there is much hand-wringing about the younger generation's lack of knowledge about it and respect for that history. But when one brings into historical discussions any facts and interpretations that contest the celebratory story and make people uncomfortable, such as the genocide of indigenous people as the foundational act in the creation of the United States, suddenly the value of history drops precipitously, and one is asked, why do you insist on dwelling in the past? This is the mark of a well-disciplined intellectual class, one that can extol the importance of knowing history for contemporary citizenship, and at the same time, argue that we shouldn't spend too much time thinking about history. This off-and-on engagement with history is not of mere academic interest. As the dominant imperial power of the moment, U.S. elites have a clear stake in the contemporary propaganda value of that history. Obscuring bitter truths about historical crimes helps perpetuate the fantasy of American benevolence, which makes it easier to sell contemporary imperial adventures, such as the invasion and occupation of Iraq, as another benevolent action. Any attempt to complicate this story guarantees hostility from mainstream culture. After raising the barbarism of America's much revered founding fathers in a lecture, I was once accused of trying to, quote, humble our proud nation and undermine young people's faith in our country. Yes, of course, that is exactly what I would hope to achieve. We should practice the virtue of humility and avoid the excessive pride that can, when combined with great power, lead to great abuses of power. History does matter, which is why people in power put so much energy into controlling it. The United States is hardly the only society that has created such mythology. While some historians in Great Britain continue to talk about the benefits that empire brought to India, political movements in India want to make the mythology of Hindutva into historical fact. Abuses of history go on in the former empire and the former colony. History can be one of the many ways we create and impose hierarchy, or it can be part of a process of liberation. The truth won't set us free, but the telling of truth at least opens the possibility of freedom. As Americans sit down on Thanksgiving Day to gorge themselves on the bounty of empire, many worry about the expansive effects of overeating on their waistlines. We would be better to think about the constricting effects of the day's mythology on our minds. And that was No Thanks to Thanksgiving by Robert Jensen, who is journalism professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, published by City Lights Books. Now I'd like to read an article or a story or just a meditation by Walt Curtis. He calls it The Harvest Moon. And a little preface by myself. This year's Harvest Moon was the night of September 27th, 28, and it was a supermoon that staged a blood moon eclipse, although it was also considered the color of rotten tomatoes. Harvest moons signify the bounty of harvest, which also defines our festival of Thanksgiving. Tonight is one night past a full moon. Look up at it as it rises and imagine its shining vaudevillian face as a bright mirror of your own, and think also of your own eclipse. Walt Curtis wrote this story or meditation for my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, a few years back. The Harvest Moon by Walt Curtis. Every year in autumn, as I drive in the country with the golden leaves falling and the crops ripening in the fields and the grass yellow and the crickets chirping incessantly, I am reminded of death and the cycle of the seasons. The swollen harvest moon is like the skull of a murdered child. The bones are laid bare by the withering of the years. Such a moon cries out for justice, but more than that, for an understanding of mortality. The one thing which is certain about death is that it is completely open as to what happens. All we can say is that death is a departure from life. It is the only absolute. Everything else that we do in life or get involved with, we have a certain amount of control over or input into. Not so with death. It has to be accepted and acquiesced to. Perhaps the harder one struggles against it, the worse the experience of dying may be. Everyone has to do it eventually. The smartest and the dumbest, the ugliest and the best looking, popes and atheists, capitalists and criminals, John Birchers and bisexuals. When he was alive, my father called death the great equalizer. So what happens when you die? No one knows for certain. As a poet growing up in rural Oregon in the fullness of my 74 years in 2015, I would like to offer some speculations. Allow me to wax poetic, if you will, even nearly incoherently so. I enjoy nature very much. Trees, rivers, mountains, open spaces. I am certain that nature is infinite. In any city, I often feel trapped, enclosed in an abstract human-made world, which is finite. I feel that with my senses instinctively, as a dog or a deer would. In nature, there is infinite variety, change, form, color, shape, force. You can go as far as a distant nebula or to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. We are never going to measure love technologically. We are never going to stop death with our machinery. Attempting these things is an insane and unnatural activity. The intellect breaks down, the spirit liberates itself, and the body takes care of itself in corruption and finds repose. The corpse turns into earth and rain, flowers, and possibly new living flesh. Driving back after having dinner with my mother on the anniversary of my father's death, a profound idea popped into my head. One never gets away from nature, not in these words on paper or these words on the radio, nor inside the comfortable cloth and metal of the automobile. The breeze blows in the windows of the car. I am breathing the breeze and adding to it. That brings me to the main point of this melancholy discussion. We must trust nature. Death is okay. Death is going to be all right when it comes in its own due time, in terms of the natural scheme of things. It would be a mistake not to die, not to leave the old forms behind. Even if that were possible, it would be a delusion of the rational mind. A civilization which attempts to escape death is making a terrible cosmic mistake. To try to escape might be to destroy life, and I think, in actuality, this is precisely what is happening. Technocrats and materialist mechanist scientists and bureaucrats are making life unbearable. Love canal, radiation from nuclear power, lead contaminants in mother's milk, PCBs in the ocean. The new technological industrial processes are disrupting and poisoning the delicate ecology of this fragile green biosphere, which we call Earth. With gene splicing and bionic medicine, these same scientists are trying to create an immortal new man, which will be part zombie and part robot. A pathetic, meaningless creature. We must die so that life itself can be reborn. I do not mean that particularly in a Christian sense, though the Christians and the Buddhists have the sense of it. You might become a purple rhododendron or a robin. A baby born in 2050 AD could be using your life force that your meat scraps lost when you died in 1985 or 2015. Where was that force being stored, or what was your soul doing in the 65 or 35 years in between time? Do you think I know what I'm speculating about? See, that is what happens when you talk about or think about death. You cannot logically pin it down until you do it. And then maybe you won't know unless or if you become conscious again. Trust your intuitive spiritual feelings. Death is going to be the easiest thing you ever do. It might even be fun in a cosmic sense. Start life over. How disappointing. I have enough respect for my life, how I have loved and lived, and whom I have been with and shared the miracle with, in its finality and one-timeness, that I accept my death and total oblivion. Transcendental humanity is less than flesh and blood humanity. Now counts. The earth counts. This ball of clay I consecrate with my spirit, as you must with yours. When I look up at the horrifying harvest moon, yes, I feel sad, but I also treasure the existential beauty of it. We only live once, and each moment of our life is unique and special, as is every human being we meet. Revel in the wonder of being before it is given back to the void. And that was Walt Curtis, The Harvest Moon. Walt is often referred to as Oregon's unofficial poet laureate. He is the author of Mala Noche, and he lives in Portland. Now I'd like to read a couple of poems. The first by Juanita Huebner. Walking Tour of Astoria. Here, where time is washed by rain, when space is marinated by water. Here, in a tripled horizon of ribbons, aquatic, terrestrial, aerial, where rivers are confluences of endless fingers feeding the palm of the ocean, the land drunken in emerald, and where the undefined pewter sky seldom dissolves from its neutral mirror into a blaze of blueness, here, in days, in nights, in all seasons, in motion, moving with the wind, murmuring its symbols, syllables, its paragraphs rhymed into neighborhoods and green-flamed forest, without a map, with only an open wonder, distant, alone, with the mind rolling forever like language of salmon and sturgeon through these rivers, against a backdrop so familiar, so wordlessly known. Burrowing inside the velvet and wax mingled by a single plant, the azaleas burning like red Christmases and conversations of leaves, and going underneath, down toward the precious burden of seeds, seeds folded by the old hands of the wind into rich, dark earth, mazes of roots, a seed falling through whispered cities of misted trees, pulled by gravity toward a subterranean birth, and below, where privacy is so extreme, it loses its shape, where tunnels are long thoughts of unspoken sentences, where questions sink into the subsoil of language, burrowing below all the misfortunes, the lost belief crushed into the faces of strangers, hearts cocooned like bottled storms, like boxed blackness wishing to ascend, to break ground and begin to walk. To walk into swallowed hours, the night so enlarged by sound, the endless chorus echoing up the slope, a chorus of seals feasting on sushi within an old wooden amphitheater of houses, cupping sound and water in a haunting music, the music like a soul in a strange aquarium, whirling out like a river of incense, above the disappearing grid of pilings capped with moss, pillars holding up a vanished history, a history of work and resources and politics. Harvests of sea and wood by unending mouths of promises and lies. Walking, where more of the dead than the living walk with us, trapped in quicksands of insomnia, the night covering its eyelid over the town with the moon, the stone navel of the sky, pure, patient, old, and ivory, a silence passing through the air, through the doors of eyes, and along the smooth, pine-stained strands of light, along arrowing spines of trees, above the great celery girders of the bridge, and straight through the woven logic of a spider's web stretched between a street pole and an early star harnessed to an October sky. Walking, dispossessed of what crowds and collapses the acquisitive world, a world nauseous from the fanfare of technology, of trinkets, of estrangement's profusion of artifacts, walking the trainless tracks, split rock and rusted rail, and toward a burnt horizon of embers, a bum's park covered by wild lilacs and cardboard, a place of stories made fluent by cheap wine and solitude, told to rock-fringed fires, told over and over again, the smoke winding and thinning from a final bed of ash. And again walking, the senses spreading to invent new adjectives for what is beautiful, the senses electric in a dervish of leaves, in a ripe labyrinth of berries, in a crow's dance of ragged wings in a sky salted with stars, the senses spearing the flying fish of gossip and contempt, using their cold, hard bones as combs for the snarls, throwing the rest into a limitless gallery of waves and moons, as circular and redundant as the town's memory. The senses like acid and sugar in a balance, the senses flowing like 20 fingers over the braille geographies of sex and secrets, and walking. The legs carve elusive limbs and twigs into the unanimous fog. The foot arcs a path from oneself to oneself, receiving horizons and letting them loose. Every image carried for a while like water in two joined hands, seeing, erasing, and each moment moving, pausing, becoming the passage which walks itself. And that was Walking Tour of Astoria by Juanita Huebner. And another poem, Astor Library by Rick Vrana. Hushed school children, bookworms, and clicking computer users in this large reading room fill a rainy Saturday sitting under a poster reading A library is not a luxury, but one of the necessities of life. Outside in the gray rain, the north wall stucco has long lost the last two letters of the town's name, and so it reads, Astor Library. Fitting reminder it is of the East Coast entrepreneur who never saw and may not have known of this place. Somewhere out there in a wild northwest that may as well have been the Far East was his trading post for otter pelts. Before they decimated the otter, before they decimated the seals, before they decimated the almost endless salmon, while on land were likewise decimated the large cats, wolves, black bear, the ancient enormous trees, the people of old tested communities, all documented in the very fine museum that shows us what was lost and what remains, a struggling American seaport fish town, striving toward survival, conceived not so much in malice as in ignorance, the inevitable prize of some sort of enterprise rich men call free. And that was Astor Library by Rick Vrana. This has been Michael McCusker. Please remember on this National Day of Gluttony that millions of Americans are not feasting today, but are most likely alarmingly close to unintentional fasting, possibly for many days, weeks, and months, even years to come. And please don't shop tomorrow on Black Friday. Happy, happy, happy.